This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program. Welcome to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. Now, here's your host, Wayne Zell.
Good morning and welcome to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, your host of this very fast-paced half hour of special topics and special guests designed to help you realize your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. So sit back with your cup of coffee and your Danish, and hopefully you'll get something out of today's show. We're talking about tax changes, of course, because there were an awful lot of them passed on January the 1st. But before I do, let me make sure that you know that this show is sponsored by and brought to you by the premier law firm of Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman, located in Reston, Virginia, serving the entire Washington, D.C. metro area with clients all across the country. If you'd like to know more about the firm and its diverse practice areas, please visit us on the web at ofplaw.com. Also, I invite you to subscribe to my blog, blueprintforwealth.org, where you'll hear the latest or see the latest or read the latest tax, estate planning, and business planning updates. Today, we're going to be talking about the Taxpayer Relief Act of 2012. This is part two, really, which talks about the estate and gift tax changes that were made as part of this major piece of legislation. You know by now that the Congress on New Year's Day passed the Taxpayer Relief Act and approved the first permanent set of estate, gift, and generation skipping transfer tax provisions in over a dozen years. The Senate approved the legislation in a bipartisan 89-8 vote about 2 hours into the new year, and the House approved it by a vote of 257-167. Twice as many Democrats as Republicans supported it, but nonetheless, it wouldn't have passed without Republican support. The politicians are going to spin this any number of ways. In the 2014-2016 campaigns, it'll be a benefit that some people say was long overdue. It's going to be a detriment as well, because included in this legislation are provisions that cause the deficit to increase by over $3.9 trillion over 10 years. Nonetheless, they still have a lot to resolve in the Congress. The debt ceiling still remains to be resolved. And also, the deficit cuts that are automatically scheduled to take place, called sequestration, will come into play unless the Congress reaches some kind of agreement on spending cuts. But the tax bill that was just passed made permanent, so supposedly permanent, the Bush tax cuts that were enacted way back in 2001, something that the Republican-led Congresses and the Democratic-led Congresses couldn't do over the last 12 years. Nonetheless, they did it. As we've discussed, income tax rates increased only on those making more than $450,000 or $400,000 for single filers, not the widely publicized level that President Obama wanted of $250,000. Also, personal exemptions are phased out, and itemized deductions are phased out for adjusted gross incomes over $300,000 joint filers, $250,000 for single. On the estate and gift tax front, one major change was made that was not in the 2012 legislation. The new rate on the high rate on estates for people dying in 2013 and beyond, a permanent rate, is 40%. It was 35% in 2012 and 2011, and way back before 2001, the rate was over 55%. The Democrats wanted 45. The Republicans were willing to settle at 35. That's how we ended up with 40. It's right the precise midpoint in between those two positions. In fact, this change in rates is the only change from the 2012 estate tax law, believe it or not. The rate change is probably the easiest change to cope with out of all the changes that were made in the 2012 Taxpayer Relief Act. Unlike the exemption, the rate doesn't have effects that carry over from year to year or from gifts to estates. And unlike more structural changes, a 5% rate change doesn't require revision of some of the techniques that we used at the end of 2012 and 2011 to take advantage of the high exemptions. The 40% rate kicks in at taxable estates or cumulative gifts of $1 million and applies to any amounts over that amount. The 35% was reached at $500,000. So for the first $1 million, the run-up for the brackets is about $54,000. The 40% gift tax rate translates into about a 29% rate exclusive if the donor survives for 3 years after the gift. It's a complicated calculation, but suffice it to say that the rates are lower than they have ever been, except for 2012 and 2011. Now, a lot of states still impose estate tax on the decedents in their states, such as Maryland and D.C. They have top tax rates of 16% for taxable estates that are over $1 million for single individuals and $2 million for married couples. Those rates will cause the effective rate that's imposed on an estate over $10.5 million to be 53.8% in 2009 compared to today about 50%. So if you have a moderately wealthy individual who's got an estate that's less than $5.25 million, which happens to be the new exemption indexed for inflation, the only fear that you've got is the fear of state death tax. And there are ways of avoiding those issues and some planning techniques available that we'll discuss in months to come. The exemption for gift, estate, and generation skipping tax remains unified, much to the surprise of me and many other tax practitioners around the country. We were expecting the Congress to allow the gift tax exemption to drop down to $1 million and then have it indexed for inflation. We were not expecting them to allow the gift tax exemption to remain at the same level as the estate tax exemption, which, again, is $5.25 million per person, which really results in a reunification that occurred in 2011 and 2012 of all of these different rate structures. And that's good news for everyone in the estate and gift tax world. Another change that wasn't made and was retained in the law that was scheduled to expire is something called portability. If you have a married couple and one of the spouses dies without using their federal tax exemption, the surviving spouse is allowed to inherit, if you will, the unused amount of the exemption. That amount remains fixed until the surviving spouse dies. In other words, it's not indexed and it doesn't increase at any point in time. And it doesn't take into consideration the fact that property may appreciate in value. So there are some downsides to portability. But it is a welcome change that was made permanent as part of the 2012 Taxpayer Relief Act. The New Year's Day legislation also makes permanent the relatively apolitical technical provisions that were passed way back in 2001. Some of these included how to allocate your generation skipping transfer tax exemption, how to calculate the GST inclusion ratio, and the extension of time that's available to pay estate tax under Code Section 6166 for businesses or estates owning interests in closely held businesses. There used to be a concern, not anymore at least, that if you died in a year when the exemption had dropped from its previous levels, that the estate may have to claw back some of the gifts that were made in the earlier years. We don't have that concern now, at least while the tax provisions remain in effect as they were approved in the Taxpayer Relief Act of 2012. So, permanence is a welcome change. It's a change that we didn't expect. And frankly, I think there was a lot of give and take on both sides of the aisle. Senator Baucus, who's a Democrat, actually supported the higher exemptions and was in support of the permanent extension of the higher exemptions. And, of course, many of the Republicans still are pushing for repeal. But permanence is only in the eyes of the beholder, because it's expected that Congress is going to undertake massive tax reform debates later this year and potentially into 2014, when the Internal Revenue Code is expected to be reviewed in its entirety and to determine how it can be changed to be made more simple for individuals and more simple for corporations. And therefore, I think the estate tax changes as well as the income tax changes will be back on the table, notwithstanding the permanent moniker that was given to them under the American Taxpayer Relief Act of 2012. Among the changes that Congress didn't make in this legislation, which is important for revenue raising, were easy changes like requiring grantor retained annuity trusts that can be as short as 2 years to have a 10-year term. This is something that the president has been pushing for since he was elected. Or limiting the duration of allocating the GST exemption, or doing away with valuation discounts for entities that are closely held and transferring interests within the family unit. Those changes were not made in the Taxpayer Relief Act of 2012, which is good news because the planning techniques arguably continue and the possibility of engaging in those planning techniques still exists, at least until tax reform is undertaken or deficit reduction revisits the tax changes that were made in the Taxpayer Relief Act of 2012. Of course, this is complicated stuff. And if you've got questions about how it affects you and how to do your estate planning or your income tax planning, give us a call at Odin Feldman and Pittleman at 703-218-2100 or visit us on the web at ofplaw.com.
You're listening to Blueprint for Wealth with Wayne Zell. Learn how to better prepare for your future when Blueprint for Wealth returns in a moment.
A Legal Minute with Wayne Zell.
Who is considered an independent contractor? Many employers use independent contractors to carry out essential aspects of their business. Many independent contractors enjoy the freedom of self-employment as they perform freelance work for various companies. But who is considered an independent contractor, and what are the implications of being so considered? The term independent contractor has its primary implications in the tax area. An independent contractor works for a business and performs distinct tasks for the employer. The IC could be a writer in a marketing company who writes for certain projects as the need arises. An IC is generally not guaranteed work, but may be tapped for jobs on an as-needed basis. The IRS's rule for determining who is an independent contractor is that the employer has control over the end result. But the independent contractor has control over how the work is going to be performed. In all cases, the IRS has the final say on whether a worker is an independent contractor.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. If you have questions for Wayne, you can email him at radio@ofplaw.com or call him at 703-218-2100. Now back to your host, Wayne Zell.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth, and we're talking with a very special guest today, Kim Walsh Phillips. Welcome, Kim. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Wayne. I appreciate it.
She's dialing in, or we dialed her in, and she is an award-winning speaker, author, strategist, and CEO of IO Creative Group, a results-driven marketing and PR agency. Kim is a techie marketing geek. I'm sure we're going to hear a lot about that today. She's got great shoes, her bio says, and has a hatred of awareness campaigns, which I'm really intrigued by, and an obsession for marketing with a sharp focus on return on investment, ROI. She's worked with brands such as Harley Davidson and Hilton Hotels to increase revenue through direct response marketing. She served as a keynote speaker in hundreds of conferences across the country and enjoys spreading her passion for marketing and social media through her tweets at at PR Guru Kim. PR Guru Kim. And she's author of the new book, which we're going to talk a little bit about today, Awareness Campaigns Are Stupid and Other Insider Secrets to Stop Being an Advertising Victim and Start Monetizing Your Marketing. So with that, why are awareness campaigns stupid? It's an interesting title. How'd you come up with that, by the way?
Well, thanks for asking. It's something I actually have put on my phone case, and I should apologize to those listening that I have a bit of a cold. We were kidding back and forth that I have kids, so it's a revolving door of sniffles in my home. But anyway, I have a background in public relations. It's what I graduated from college with, and worked in the corporate PR world, and then had the wonderful opportunity to start a PR firm. And as the economy got tighter and folks were looking for things to cut, the first thing that they would cut from their budget, our clients, would be their marketing and PR efforts. Because while we could show we were getting them a lot of media, we couldn't show a specific return on their investment. So I started researching, how can I prove our worth more? At the same time, I got a little bit better at sales, so I started, pounding the pavement, going out and selling, and so we started doing better. But then I had my first daughter, and so I couldn't go after this funnel of money as much. And so we're losing clients out the back end, and I'm not bringing clients in quickly as the front end. And I'm looking at my new child and suffering from the fact that I have to figure out, am I going to stay home with her for, the weeks that she should have as a newborn, or am I going to go back to work to start selling again so I can pay my staff?
Right.
And it was this horrible conundrum to be in, and I thought, I can never be in this situation again. So I started looking at how can we create a system to bring in leads on a consistent basis and show our clients our return so that we don't keep losing them, we can keep them and grow them. And discovered this world of direct response marketing. So now, no ads, no campaigns, nothing that we do is just awareness-based. Everything we do is based in looking at what could it produce, what's the estimated return on every dollar spent, and then tracking to make sure that it does that. So we went from, going after awareness for clients to actually being able to provide a weekly report of this is what we said we would do and what it would return. Well, when we're doing it for them, it starts to make you look at the entire marketing world differently. So it could be kind of annoying to ride in a car with me because I look at these billboards,
Yeah. And
it's frustrating because I see folks losing money because they're just doing their awareness campaign ads, and to me that's just setting it on fire. So now it's my mission not just to do things for our clients and, for our folks that work with us, but to spread the word. That's why I wrote the book, so other people could be aware of that, and small businesses especially, when the money's so tight, they could stop wasting their money on awareness-only campaigns.
Right. So when you say that you're always able or trying to measure ROI in terms of an awareness campaign, or not an awareness campaign, but the marketing dollars that are being spent, how do you do that? I mean, for example, I have a radio show, right? And we sponsor the radio show, and sometimes we get clients, sometimes we get connections, but how do you measure ROI on all these dollars that are being spent? And maybe they shouldn't be spent.
Right, sure. So there are a lot of things that when folks start looking at this marketing this way, that they would make decisions a little bit differently. And again, I don't want to say that nothing for awareness is wrong, but it should be the first step in a marketing system.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're building awareness, you want to be able to do some type of call to action that would turn your awareness campaign into a marketing campaign that can actually make you money.
Okay.
Because if you offer a call to action in every marketing piece you have with a time-sensitive action that you want them to take with a compelling reason and some added incentive for them to do so and give them a deadline, you can see directly what was your response from that and what did you get in the door. Now, it doesn't need to be a sale. I recommend that folks never start with a sale as the first thing they do when they reach out to folks, because that's not how we want to be marketed to. We want to get to know people. We want to build trust with them. We want to get, talk to our friends and neighbors about it before we end up doing it, especially because we've seen too many things go wrong. So the first step would be to capture the lead so that you could start to engage them in a conversation. So
Okay. The
radio program, I'm sure, is a first step in attraction and then engagement and building that trust.
Right.
And that's how marketing should be, more of a relationship builder than trying to go right from not knowing anything about you to becoming a sale.
Is that what you mean by monetizing your marketing?
Yeah, so when you monetize your marketing, you want to make sure that you plan ahead of time how that marketing initiative should eventually develop into a sale. So you should look at customers as their lifetime relationship that you want to have from them, from their first interaction with you
right.
to becoming a customer, remaining a customer, increasing their sales, and giving you introductions. Too many companies have the marketing and sales department working in silos. I know that was the case for some of the major corporations I've worked with, and they really need to talk to each other. Marketing should be providing strong leads to the sales department that they could then utilize in order to increase the company's revenue.
And research as well, so that the salespeople know that they're going after the right leads.
Exactly. So we're not just trying to do that statement of throw a bunch of spaghetti against the wall. We're going and seeing what sticks. We're going after a targeted market that we know actually could benefit from what we have to offer,
mm-hmm.
and that we're not, you know, the most successful companies don't waste the time of their salespeople in prospecting. If you have great sales part people, you want them to spend their time selling. You want them to be in front of the best possible leads so they can make the best case and have the greatest chance of closing. So your marketing really should fulfill the need to get those prospects through the door. If they can provide those sales, your sales team with qualified leads, could be incredibly beneficial to your profits.
So in the book, you mentioned that marketing should be a lot more like dating. What do you mean by that?
So during my uncomfortable single years of dating.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't dated in like 30 years. It's been a long time. But
but you could probably think back just a little bit. But from being a woman, I had a different probably perspective on it, but
right.
there were two types of guys that I knew when I was set up with them that it wouldn't necessarily work out so well. So one was the narcissist, that he would show up with, you know, a shirt that was a little too tight to show me that he worked out all the time, and the beautiful smile, and he was really pretty, but he would talk all night about himself, and
right.
the only time he would ask me a question was to ask me why I went out with him,
okay.
which is really just more about him.
Okay.
And then the too serious, too soon guy was the one who, by the second date, and uncomfortably even one time on the first date, asked me about, you know, meeting each other's family and getting married and bringing up many things that I was not at all ready for.
Right.
So that's what we do in marketing sometimes. You know, too many of us look at, we're either the narcissist, that we make our messaging all about ourselves.
Right.
Or we're the too serious, too soon guy, that we're looking to engage the prospect in a sale when we just met each other. And both of those relationships are uncomfortable and not engaging and won't build trust. So you really want to think of marketing in terms of a great courtship, that you first are attracted to each other. Then you are to go through a process of courtship that you're dating. Then you make the sale, which I can relate back to getting married.
Yeah.
You upsell, which would be buying your house and having kids. You get in a strong relationship. And then this is the far-fetched one, because we're not talking about multiple marriages. So the introduction piece, I compare that to bringing, you know, helping to set up your friends with each other.
Oh, there you go. Okay, good. I like that. It's a great analogy, because it really, it's a good visual. And it,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you are in sales, and all of us are to some degree, I mean, if you're in
sure.
professional services or you're selling product, you always have something to sell. But the question is it all about you, or is it all about the prospective customer? And
right.
I think it's all about the prospective customer. But then, you know, okay, at the end of the lunch, you know, should you say, well, you know, I'd like to, you know, to represent you, or I'd like to provide services to you. It's really, I think it's more like, how can I help you? And
exactly. If you focus it on them, because people don't buy for our reasons, they buy for their reasons. And if we can discover through a process of attracting the right folks to doing some great research about what those reasons might be, what their pain points are, then all of our marketing should be about addressing those pain points
mm-hmm.
and not making it about us, but really, really targeting. Because we happen to have a strong marketing component in the social media world, and I'm of the mindset that I would much rather our clients have 1,000 incredibly qualified leads than a million fans, because we're looking for them not to waste any time of their sales staff, their marketing materials, on anybody who won't make a purchase from them. So the idea behind the marketing piece is that to go after that incredibly qualified lead so you can bring it into a sale.
Is Facebook or social media marketing expensive, or is it very inexpensive?
You can go either way.
Okay.
If you are going to do things on your own, so you're not enlisting the help of outside resources, it can be incredibly time-consuming, but
right.
very inexpensive.
Right.
So if you are willing to engage your audience in conversations and be on there during the day and chit-chat, then you can keep your engagement level high.
Right.
But Facebook has it optimized now that if you are just like a once-a-day poster
right.
for a business, a very small percentage of your audience is going to see your posts. And you can pay to optimize those, but then it can get very expensive.
So
if you spend time doing it, it can be cheap. But if you don't, it's expensive.
You're the expert. They need to turn to you for this. Now, one of the things that the book also made a point of is that people shouldn't be allocating a percentage of their overall expenditure budget to marketing. Why? Why is that?
Right. So that's one of those questions. I have the wonderful opportunity that I get to speak to a lot of different groups. And one of the main questions I usually get is, what percentage of my budget should I allocate to marketing? And the reality is, I would like to look for you to look at it this way. If you went to the doctor and, you were told that if you didn't have a heart surgery, you were going to have a heart attack and die, or something serious was going to happen, your first question would generally not be, how much money am I going to have to spend to make this happen? Your first look at it would be, what do I need to do to fix this?
Okay.
And that's really how you need to look at marketing, and it's really with any business issue. But, with marketing, you have to look at, what is the lifetime value of my customer, how much can I look at getting them over the spectrum of their life cycle, and then how much of that am I willing to allocate to recruiting them, and then can that effectively do that? So instead of trying to go after the cheapest possible solutions, which is what the most folks will do,
yeah.
you really want to look at, how can I effectively recruit the highest per value customer I can go after.
Okay. Our listeners out there, they're varied in terms of their background. What's
sure.
the one thing our listeners, in the DC metro area can do to get a higher return on their marketing dollars?
So the main thing that you can do to starting with the next ad that you put out, the next thing that you do is to turn it into a moneymaker for you, is to put that call to action in place. If it's a pretty ad without a call to action, it's art.
Okay.
If it has a call to action, that's when you get into marketing. So you want to always make sure that you give your respondent an opportunity to give you their contact information. So whether or not that's what you give them, an opportunity to get a free report, download a coupon, enter their information on a website to sign up for an e-newsletter, enter a contest, whatever that might be, capture their information so you can start communicating with them on an ongoing basis, so you can build a relationship with them and have a greater chance of turning them into a customer down the road, and one that already knows who you are and what you do, so you have a much stronger chance of making a sale, and you have a much stronger chance of having a higher per customer value.
So if our folks want more information from you, how do they get it?
Sure. So we set up a special offer. Folks want to get the book, and it's a nice, inexpensive book. I think it's around $13 on Amazon. They can go to iocreativegroup.com/ACS offer. So Awareness Campaigns are Stupid Offer, ACS offer. And we did something special for you folks, that anyone who buys a copy of the book, if they want to submit the form, I'm going to create a special report, and it's the secrets to effective Facebook advertising. So the stuff I was talking to you about, how you can do some stuff yourselves and save a lot of money, I put it together in a free report for you, and you'll get it as a bonus just for buying the book and letting us know that you did it on our page.
Excellent. Kim, thanks for being a special guest on Blueprint for Wealth.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Everyone, thanks for listening to Blueprint for Wealth, and join us next week for another special topic and special guest. And call us if you need any information at 703-218-2100. I'm Wayne Zell. And have a great week.
You've been listening to Wayne Zell and Blueprint for Wealth. Wayne will be back next Saturday morning at 10 a.m. with your Blueprint for Wealth right here on 1500 AM. WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now.